Hi everyone, you're listening to The Blockchain Socialist, and for today's interview I have Mike Watson. He's the co-host of The Acid Left and author of Towards a Conceptual Militancy and Can the Left Learn to Meme, with an upcoming book, The Meming of Mark Fisher, coming out this September. So hey Mike, how you doing?
Hey, hi, thanks for having me here.
This is, I think, going to be a really interesting interview, just considering all of the recent events the past months with GameStop and with the rise of crypto tokens, especially the meme ones like Dogecoin, because we're going to be talking a lot about memes. And as much as its focus is usually towards sort of a right-wing politics, there's also a left-wing politics to it. And I think you've written about some of the intricacies and the importance of memes in your books. But maybe before we get into that, I would be really interested to know how you first got interested in memes as a topic of research.
Okay, well as I say in the second book, Can the Left Learn to Meme, I basically, there's kind of two trajectories. I was very into the internet, which sounds a funny thing to say today. I'm into the internet, as we're all using it all the time, but I was kind of into it in the 90s, and just into the potential in this kind of geeky left-wing way that some people were in the 90s, and in a very naive way as well, that we kind of thought that, you know, because the internet could be used by all, you know, potentially in many different countries, that it would then lead to some kind of mass global democracy and maybe leftist movement. And yeah, that didn't really come to fruition at all. But I kind of stayed with the internet and got into the era of theory blogging, when Mark Fisher had his blog as K-Punk, Graham Harman, Levi Bryant, Nick Sternacek, all these people. And, you know, there were all these kind of other people around them with their perhaps less read blogs. But it was a great moment because it was kind of non-hierarchical, a moment when professors were still very distant from their students, less so than today. This is going back to the first decade of this century. And yeah, so I was kind of really into that. But at the same time, I was studying art theory, kind of philosophical aesthetics, and from that ended up writing for several art magazines, writing reviews and kind of then curating. So I ended up in the art world and very into like the potential of an art for everybody, which is very much embedded in the history of avant-garde art, but which has never really come about because avant-garde art has always been kind of quite elitist, and then avant-garde modern art, contemporary art, and then in any case, I mean, the art world remains a kind of cold and distant place, a place where many people don't feel comfortable. So it kind of occurred to me that whilst teaching as a professor in two American universities in Italy, where I lived for 10 years, up until 2 years ago, I was teaching in a communications department, despite being kind of more oriented towards art theory. And I got more and more into communications, teaching kind of generalized visual culture to BA students, and then kind of realized that actually this kind of promise of a culture for everybody does exist, but online, not in the art world. So the kind of avant-garde dream of an art for all did manifest, but not as we wanted it to. So then you get to what you do with that. We have a kind of something approaching a democracy of cultural expression, but people end up making kind of cat memes, selfies, belfies, and then, you know, right wing, far right wing memes, your right emerged, you know, in the last few years, leading to Trump's election. Kind of, I don't think it really got him elected, but anyway, it kind of was part of that, and then we end up with QAnon now and the 6th of January storming of the Capitol building. So it's all gone kind of terribly wrong, but I still think it has huge potential. So that second book was really about that potential, and I kind of looked at Theodore Adorno of the Frankfurt School, and his idea that abstraction is maybe more valuable than a very direct politically themed art, because art that is very kind of directly political, kind of runs up against conflicts all the time. So I don't have a favorite in abstract art. So I kind of say, well, you know, I don't have many abstract memes, but the internet as a sum whole of all its memes is kind of abstract and chaotic. And maybe from that, something new can emerge. But I wasn't like particularly hopeful that it would. It's just a kind of an example of hope existing even in our dire times.
No, I think that's really interesting because my impression of how I understand at least memes and its connection to the art world is that art history is also a history of memes. And I guess the internet sort of democratized that thing that was sort of contained within, I guess, like the elite art world of the past has now sort of become opened up, and now it's sort of what it's become today.
Yeah, I mean, that's another angle. Yeah, that there is a kind of mimetic element to art, and there have been strong elements, of openness and of trying to kind of spread culture to everybody, either, you know, because any object can now be an artwork, or maybe you could say anyone can be an artist. You know, it's increasingly the case that anybody can, anyone can have access to perhaps art school. I mean, within certain parameters, certainly many more people than before. But yeah, then you have images which kind of spread, and you get that going right back to the Renaissance, but even cave painting, because you end up, you know, with the same kind of motifs turning up in caves, inexplicably on different continents and things. But you know, that's something which is very interesting, but gets onto a very different issue, because you have abstract patterns in cave painting that are similar across different continents where people can't have been in contact, and it suggests that there are kind of archetypal images that emerge possibly in the dark, because caves are kind of dark. So maybe people were kind of like drawing the patterns which emerged, you know, in a kind of semi-dream state. But, you know, that's to say that kind of memes already existed back then. But in Renaissance art, you get the same thing of like if you portray a saint, they have the objects of their martyrdom. So if you have Catherine, she was strapped to a wheel and stoned and burnt or something. They're all kind of gruesome, obviously. So you often have like a broken wheel with her. And then there's Peter as the keys to heaven, all of this stuff. So that's kind of a meme, because, you know, they're portrayed the same way all the time. So, yeah, I mean, it's always kind of been there.
I guess it's particularly interesting thinking about how, like, art itself, like, doesn't, like, it allows you to dream on stuff, but it doesn't actually act on anything. So, but at the same time, these memes have sort of, like, caused changes in history, I guess you could say, like with Christianity and, yeah, I mean, countless other sort of strong symbolism, I guess, if you count that as memes.
There are examples for sure of imagery really having a profound effect on society, and also the means of reproduction of imagery. So you think about the Gutenberg press, which led to the Protestant Reformation, or the internet recently, but also, yeah, the actual images themselves or messages which are contained on, you know, in books, pamphlets, or on the internet, etc. I mean, I think it's quite clear that symbolism is a huge part of getting a political idea across. It's often kind of said that, you know, one is either more political or more cultural. So you have your Karl Marx, who hardly ever talks about art itself. Then you have Benjamin Adorno, etc., who talk a lot about culture but don't go into depth into economics. But these things are actually pretty much connected. I don't think one has to be like a cultural person or an economic person. I think they're codependent.
Yeah. Maybe talking about the political angle, what is sort of the, I guess, to you, the emancipatory potential of memes, but how do also memes get co-opted under capitalism today?
I think just like the way that anybody can make an image or text and put it out there is emancipatory, and it's something which we take for granted now, and it was very different in the 90s when I was in I guess, well, for the British, I was in college and uni, but in America, it's like high school and college. But, you know, back then we had, maybe we could make like fanzines, much the same as people were making in the 70s. We get like photocopiers and make Xerox publications. They were kind of fun, but nothing like we have now. We have just so much potential to make stuff. And that's one of the things I say, that the millennial generation is Adornian in this one respect, because Adorno kind of said, one can't make art after the horrors of Auschwitz, or at least he literally said one can't make poetry, but he meant more widely art after Auschwitz, because it's just so horrific, but also because it suggests that we've come so far in materializing, in objectifying all of human existence, that we can't make something that we could consider to be art, like pointing to some kind of transcendental better reality, because we've just kind of gone past it into some kind of, you know, dismal reality. But Adorno says that, but in one of the famous essays he says it in, called On Commitment, he then says that we have to continue making art anyway, so that we don't surrender to cynicism. And I think that's interesting today, because it's kind of what we're doing. You see people who are deeply kind of pissed off. Millennials didn't even get a moment of like thinking they might have a revolution, whereas most generations before, or the previous three or so, did. Generation Z are the same. Or Zoomers, however you call them. So, you know, there is this deep negativity, but they're always making. And it's kind of their way of, like, establishing meaning or some kind of sense of frail hope. So I think that has a lot of value. But I think at the same time, like, I can't imagine individual memes doing much. I don't think many left-wing memes are likely to change something in themselves. I think it's more the sum of memes. Which kind of destabilize, but this is somehow benefiting the right more than the left. So the sum of memes are kind of destabilizing the historical narratives which keep society together, but somehow that's kind of like leading to a right-wing moment, not a left-wing one, with Trump, Brexit, Bolsonaro, etc. So yeah, I mean, how to deal with that, I don't know, because I think we've got a long way to push through. I mean, this internet is quite recent. And I think that the right-wing movements are coming about because people look at the internet, it empowers them to some degree, and then they think, right, I can have what I want. I don't need to wait on a professor, a so-called expert, to get information. So, you know, fuck all these, you know, mostly middle-class gatekeepers. And, you know, by extension, they also want political power. And then people like Trump and Johnson say, you know, we'll give it to you, but they're really lying. But that's how they're getting in to power. So, you know, this tendency has begun, but I think it has to play through, and people will kind of sense that they've been duped more and more. And maybe we'll be able to, like, talk to people about what a real kind of power or democracy would be.
Do you think the left has improved in its memeing abilities? I feel like potentially, maybe it's just me being more on Twitter, at least. I feel like I've noticed more left-wing memes becoming popular, or at least going viral for a bit.
I mean, there has been like a lot of activity. I'm seeing more on Insta, because I happen to be there quite a lot, because the Acid Left have this platform that I'm working with my co-host, Adam Ray Atkins. We have an Instagram, which we're quite active on, and I've been watching a lot of stuff, and there's a massive kind of Mark Fisher moment happening. People are memeing Mark Fisher a lot, and of course this is positive to some degree, although I think you kind of did ask a question about this earlier, but I didn't get to it. This kind of signals a co-optation of an anti-capitalist or left-wing message. This is kind of good and bad. You're seeing a lot of left-wing messages, left-wing philosophers in memes. You get sometimes short texts or, you know, words alluding to their theory, but often it's not enough to really convey their theory. And sometimes the messages are more just kind of jokey, particularly around Max Stirner and Mark Fisher. And it's kind of funny, because Mark Fisher was like, you know, he was saying in his book, which is something that comes down from the Frankfurt School, he was really saying that capitalism has this capacity to co-opt its opposition. And then you see him being used as a meme. And of course, memes always feeding back into the capitalist system, because they make data for the big kind of social media giants and for Google, etc. But also, kind of, he kind of co-opts his message and generally left-wing messages, because the internet runs at such a speed that you can't spend any time really with a meme. So it demands that memes be very kind of catchy, but not say very much. So it kind of, it detracts from left-wing philosophy, from things one needs to spend time with more than perhaps right-wing messages that can be conveyed in more kind of simple, aggressive ways. So this is kind of unfortunate, and actually is a big theme in the book I'm having published by Zero Books in September, which is called, as you said earlier, The Memeing of Mark Fisher, but the subtitle is How the Frankfurt School Foresaw Capitalist Realism and What to Do About It, i.e. What to Do About Capitalist Realism, the phenomenon. Fisher comes into that, although it's actually more in the Frankfurt School, because literally he's become a meme. And I don't know how much he would even like that. But, you know, we can't know, but that is discussed a little bit. But without wanting to divulge too much about that book right now, memes are doing well. But the thing is, I think it's certainly more left-wing memes. So in that sense, doing well, we're doing well. But I think we need to start doing this on our own terms, because we have the means to spread messages, but we're doing it at the pace of capitalism, at the pace of data capitalism. And that is really impeding any kind of depth of thought or discussion. So we tend to get in mud throwing competitions or matches between different different factions of the left. So we need to do better. So we need to slow down. I think we need to slow down the internet base. We need to slow down the use of it. And I think that's really decidedly unappealing to probably most Zoomers and millennials. So I have got this idea called Slow Memes. But I think it needs a new name. Anyway, we need to slow down memes. We need to develop them more kind of consciously, but also receive them in a slower, more reflective way. And I think that would enable for more reading as well. I know there's a joke about the left just putting way too much text in memes, but I think that sometimes it's great, you know, when you see memes getting people reading, or initiatives like reading groups on YouTube, etc. So slowing down our use of memes might enable for some more reading. I would just say that we need to take control of the internet more somehow.
I definitely agree. Taking control of the internet is something that we're going to have to do, just, I think, considering the digital nature and like how the digital is sort of taking over our lives more and more, and how it was just sort of put on a hyperdrive during this pandemic.
Yeah, for sure. The pandemic has sped it up. It's sped everything up. I mean, sped that up, and it sped up a kind of... it's kind of a wealth gap. It certainly will lead to a wealth gap. I don't know how else I could describe it, but a kind of internet gap. Because basically, if you don't have a good internet connection now, or you're not very literate, you're really in trouble. There's a number of things happening. It does seem to expedite capitalism, or this kind of rise of data capitalism, and punish the poor even more in various different ways.
So on your show, The Acid Left, you guys talk a lot about writers like the late Mark Fisher, as you've done already. He's the author of the book Capitalist Realism, which I definitely recommend people check out. It's a good book. But what is the connection between Mark's work and memes to you?
I mean, he did actually meme. He made memes, but he had a Facebook account. But now somehow it escapes me the name, and I have written about it recently. But it was basically about dysfunctional capitalist culture, and he actually ends up taking it down. And he took it down back then. To take down a Facebook group, I guess it was, you had to delete every single member one by one. So people were watching the members go down and watching themselves be removed. There were several thousand members, and I think there was a conversation going on about what's happening. And then it turned out that Mark Fisher had been deleting them because he got fed up, because it was kind of not serving its purpose, because people were posting so much trash. Given that, I think he would find very difficult the current moment in terms of memes, because there are now so many philosophical meme pages, you have Freud, Foucault, Zizek, you have a couple of Fisher pages at least. I mean, basically, you take a large kind of recent philosopher and there'll be a Facebook page, but they often get bombarded with nonsense. It depends partly on how well they're how would you say, moderated. But I get the kind of non-moderation approach because that goes with, you know, these kind of left-wing theories, but it often ends up in a lot of kind of edgelords and often kind of people kind of pushing right-wing messages. You know, I find this even a bit difficult myself, but I am quite a bit younger, I'm happy to say, than Fisher, but not that much younger. But yeah, I mean, I'm not, there's certainly people way younger than me now online. I mean, a lot of people on these forums are in their late teens, and that's great, it's brilliant. But you get all kinds of craziness. One cannot control the conversation. I mean, the thing is, one doesn't really want to control a conversation, but it's going back to blogging, theory blogging, you had this brilliant moment where you couldn't very easily talk to your own professor because they were normally very detached still and wooden. But you could find other professors online, like Graham Harman on his blog, and he'd often answer personal emails. So it was this kind of real shaking up of academia because it wasn't long before professors kind of felt they couldn't really maintain their distance anymore, you know, in that way of, you know, simply answering to genuine theoretical questions students had about their topic, which they would have otherwise ignored and run away after class or whatever. There tends to be more of accommodation of student questions and stuff. So, you know, it's great that happened. What you find now, though, is that people don't give a damn whether you've been a professor, you are a professor, you have a PhD, you've got some books out, etc. They will just like literally shout you down and call you names on, you know, on platforms and call you boomer and stuff, which is kind of funny. And you get to thinking, you know, what should one do about this? There are no easy answers. You know, I'm totally up for the chaotic approach. You know, letting things kind of realign socially. And maybe discourse to realign so much. I mean, you get people who are worried about people. Well, I've already kind of gone into this about not reading. I think people should read. But on the other hand, you know, there's always the idea that, well, maybe people just won't read. Maybe this image culture will throw up new forms of dialogue. You know, why do things have to be done in the old way? So I mean, I'm open in that way. But on the other hand, you get this kind of fear. You're open in that way, then you see stuff happening. You're like, oh shit. This goes too far in this direction, you know, we have less reading, and web is replacing it doesn't seem to be producing anything very good. See what I mean? So I'm really in two minds about this.
For me as well, I mean, it's sort of like on one hand, reading has sort of helped me in like having my own understanding about the world and like its relation to politics and economics. And I want to encourage other people to read as much as I did. But on the other side, like, I know a lot of people don't want to read as much as maybe I do. But I also would like to convey the same ideas from what I've read and try to like pass on that knowledge in some form and in some way. And I feel, I guess it's, you sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place where you're like, okay, should I just sort of crudely summarize, you know, something that sounds catchy and funny to someone so that they understand some bit of it? Or am I sort of butchering the whole thing and maybe they can misinterpret this interpretation into something worse?
Yeah, it's very tricky to know how far to go in terms of telling people what to do. Like, you know, you should read this. And then, you know, what degree to explain it and, you know, then explain it in layman's terms. Because, you know, then you're missing some of the detail. But then, you know, many philosophers just you know, waffle far too much. Their texts are far too dense and they don't need to be that dense. It takes a certain type of person to be a philosopher. So you end up with these, you know, very needlessly complex texts in some cases. But, you know, you get these kind of things like on the Mark Fisher forums, there's this question often asked, like, is this accelerationism? Somebody will post a picture. And then, no, or acceleration would be one, yeah, but also the hauntology. or even capitalist realism, but, you know, should we say someone posts an image, maybe take it from a horror film, and they say, is this hauntology? And sometimes they're kind of spot on and sometimes not. Hauntology is a term derived by Derrida, which basically means that ontology, the act of being, is haunted by the past and the potential future. So we're never really being in the now. We're led by kind of past and future dreams, or past regrets and future dreams. It's just this, is this kind of thing is funny, as if that's a way of doing philosophy. So you just post on a forum, is this ontology, is this communism? And you're going to get an answer. It's like, just go and read the book, you know, or Wikipedia entry at least. But then you're getting kind of ironic takes, because you get this happen so much that somebody else starts winding people up. You know, is this hauntology? And then posting a completely inappropriate picture. So it just becomes a kind of a mantra, which probably gets people thinking about what hauntology is. But still, I don't know.
It reminds me of like the whole situation with Medicare for All, and sort of, first of all, Republicans or conservatives in the U.S. will say, you know, anything that is remotely resembles human rights as like being communism. But especially with the whole Medicare for All one, where, you get a lot of very strong reactions sometimes from people that this is, you know, this is socialism. But then sometimes as well, you'll have people who are maybe more left-leaning also saying that Medicare for All is socialism. And on one side, you want to be like, well, no, it's not. It's actually this whole other thing of, workers owning the means of production. But at the same time, Medicare for All would be a drastic improvement to the healthcare system in America. So why get bogged down in all the details whenever you can just say, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. Can you support it now?
Yeah. I mean, it's so difficult now with the term socialism, because you have Trump saying that Biden's socialist. Yeah. Then you have a number of people on the left saying that Bernie Sanders isn't nearly socialist enough. So, and Bernie Sanders isn't, I guess, really a socialist. But I guess that's what he's striving towards, but he's not going to outright call himself that or aim for that, like in his manifesto. But, it's a very confused territory at the moment.
Hey everyone, if you're enjoying this episode so far, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, share with a friend, and join the crypto leftist communities on Discord or Reddit, which you can find links to in the show notes. If you want to be sure that more content that explores blockchain and the potential it has for the left can be created, you can donate to my efforts through Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/theblockchainsocialist, you can donate starting at $3 a month to help me out and join the newest patrons like Leith, S.W. Hopkinson, YOLO Swaggins, Ephem, and George. At the moment, I've spent more on this project than I've ever earned from it due to hosting costs, so any amount really helps. As a patron, you'll get a shout out on an episode like I just did, and access to monthly Patreon exclusive Q&A episodes where you can submit and vote on questions you'd like me to answer, and I'll give my thoughts in roughly 20 minutes. On the latest Patreon exclusive Q&A episode, I gave my thoughts on the relationship between the rise of blockchain and the evolution of capitalism. Of course, I'll still be making free content like this interview to help spread the message that blockchain doesn't need to be used to further entrench capitalist exploitation if we put our efforts into it. So if that message resonates with you, I hope you'll consider helping out. You might also notice that my audio quality is a bit better than it was before, and that's because I purchased a better microphone thanks to the donations of patrons, so thank you to those who've been able to help. But I think that's enough for me. Let's get back to the interview with Mike Watson from The Acid Left. So maybe now we can start slowly shifting towards crypto world, since the crypto world is filled with memes, as you probably already know. But I'm just curious, maybe just from a broad perspective, what are your general thoughts on how memes are used in the cryptocurrency space?
I haven't been looking very much at specific memes about crypto. I'm more kind of aware of how crypto is developing memetically. And then, of course, that you have this Dogecoin, which grew out of the Doge, the dog meme. And that's very interesting how that's kind of grown up in the last few weeks through memes at the same time as this. Was it the GameStop? So, yeah, I don't know. I think like a lot more in those terms. I mean, it's really something I'm actually thinking about a lot recently, in the sense that it is kind of like memetic finance, and it has all the characteristics of memes, you know, in regard of how memes have modified culture and make culture democratic. So there's potential for memes now making crypto democratic, and in fact crypto is kind of like a meme anyway. So yeah, those are kind of my initial fairly scattered thoughts.
Yeah, speaking about maybe the GameStop fiasco as well, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, now it's been a while since it happened. It feels like forever, even though it wasn't that long ago. But there was a lot of use of memes. And to me, it was really uncanny how that moment sort of relied on very similar, like, mimetic strategies around memes, and like how closely it resembled cryptocurrencies and like how memes were used there. So it was like a co-optation of that culture. So to me, it wasn't really surprising how there was a lot of excitement in the crypto space and plenty of posts around Wall Street Bets that were shilling also for crypto, and whether, you know, sort of taking that moment to like create anti-traditional finance type of sentiment, I guess, sort of promoting Bitcoin and also promoting Dogecoin in some like nihilistic way, you know. So in similar how, I don't know if you're in the GameStop one, there was the meme where people would just say, they would just post like, I like the stock, because they would say that because you know, they, it was like sort of a way to signal, you know, as if the SEC was paying attention to their subreddit. So they say they like the stock, it was not for like, you know, market manipulation. It's sort of similar how they sort of did the same thing for Dogecoin, and you know, they just like the Dogecoin, they just like the meme.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I got lost there.
I was just curious. Yeah, I started rambling, but like your thoughts on the GameStop fiasco and its use of memes, how it developed.
I guess it basically just, you know, did exactly what we thought memes and crypto would eventually do if they ever came together. And I guess they've been kind of, you know, there's been a strong mimetic kind of element in crypto for a long time, but this kind of exploded. I guess it just took GameStop to ignite people's imaginations, I think, because there's this kind of nostalgia for the high street at the moment, and then, you know, for gaming and the idea of going and buying tangible games, and that, you know, that met with memes, the possibility of rescuing a company and wielding some kind of power, and of course the possibility of being an investor. And you know, I think it was both simultaneously very encouraging and quite frightening. I think very encouraging because it kind of suggests we can restructure finance, it can be a thing for the people, but frightening because of course it isn't at all a thing for the people. It's still, you know, very much an individualist pursuit that threatens being even more kind of unregulated, or at least more aggressive and wayward than it already is. You know, so there is this kind of, there are these two kind of aspects. This potential risk, and then, you know, the possibility that, hey, we could have socialism or something, you know, or something if we can all take part in the economy. So I mean, I think it kind of signals that there is the thing that started with Napster basically has to work its way through every part of society, and it really started with the internet. I mean, so the internet starts, anyone can like upload stuff, so then that leads to questions asked about how one consumes music, and then it goes through film, literature. So literature still has, I mean, the big companies, the traditional kind of way of buying books still has some kind of hold, although, you know, through Kindle, etc., but still, you know, one publishes books and sells them. But this is being broken down, you know, a lot. You can really get a lot of PDFs quite easily, or publications if you want to find them online for free. And this is now kind of shifting into politics. As I said earlier, that I think you get this kind of rise of the right wing, because people believe they should be able to make political choices because they've been making so many other kinds of choices online. And then I think now you have this going into the economic realm. And I think it's inevitable. And I think it's going to go right through everything and upturn everything. We just don't know what's going to come out of it yet. I think, you know, if we imagine that the culture kind of becoming something that anyone can have a hand in, people can make their own images and publish them. So then somebody gets a bright idea of, hey, what if we start publishing swastika images or whatever? You know, that's kind of gone very sour. So, you know, if you imagine that happening with the economy, I don't know where it's going to go. And I think crypto generally has a long way to go. So not just like investing in crypto or investing in shares, you know, in ways in which people used to invest only in crypto, i.e. online, buying small amounts and doing that kind of very quickly, you know, on a whim. I think, you know, that's one thing, but I think just crypto in terms of blockchain technology, so not strictly cryptocurrency, but blockchain technology and potential that has for freeing people or making them feel that they are more free and then there's less of a hierarchical structure, that is still got a long way to play through. And I think the internet, it kind of has mostly symbolically led to these structural changes in that it's given people information, which obviously is a big part of the kind of restructuring of society that's going on now. But it's also symbolized a new power structure, i.e. one that isn't top down, one that's kind of dispersed. So I think if we kind of think about the blockchain and what that means, and essentially I'm not very good at explaining blockchain, but let's just say it means you don't just have value currency kind of held in very few banks and guaranteed by, should we say, nation states. You have currency that can be held and guaranteed by many, many people on their home computers, for example, or in mining facilities for crypto. But it disperses money. But if you disperse not just money, but like basically everything, so, you know, the cultural value of artworks, you can probably think of many more examples, but, you know, these are not things which are held by, you know, a few people. They can now be held by everyone. So I think what this does, once people start to understand what it's doing, what this does to power symbolically is going to be huge. And I think that we're going to see this kind of upending of the power structure to an extent that where the lines have now become completely blurred. You can't really say, you know, we're going to vote left, right, or whatever, and then things are just emerging we never would expect it politically. It will become very fuzzy is what I mean. We can expect this thing to continue, and I don't know what it's going to do to society. I think we have to hold on for our lives for the ride.
That was definitely one of the messages that I've gotten. I think that a lot of people can agree with, wherever you are on the political spectrum, is that after the whole GameStop fiasco, things are going to be different. Things have changed, or that they will change. I think it's still a bit unclear what exactly it is, but at the very least, it sparked some bit of an idea of like how, you know, a frenzy could be like targeted onto like doing a very specific thing, that thing being like buying GameStop or AMC or like Dogecoin or whatever, or something like that. So I think it was very interesting in terms of opening up the imagination just a little bit, still within the confines of like the markets and capitalism.
I mean, still within the markets now, so it's not even getting anywhere near what I just described. But that's where it's like, where is that a moment which is kind of worrying, because it just makes very many more individualist investors. It wasn't really a challenge to capitalism by any means. But yeah, I think there's reason to be positive, other than that. I mean, even making many more rich people, many more millionaires is not a bad thing in itself, you know, whilst we kind of try and get actual socialism happening. That's maybe it goes some way towards that, I don't know.
One of the things I also noticed during that whole the whole frenzy was how memes were sort of enforcing or like creating volatility in markets. I don't know if you noticed it, but especially with Dogecoin, everybody was like looking at Elon Musk's Twitter profile, just waiting for him to tweet. Like as soon as he would tweet the meme, the price of Dogecoin would skyrocket. You know, it would go up by 20% every time Elon Musk, you know, he didn't even have to say Dogecoin. He didn't even have to say Doge. If he said anything remotely related to a dog, then it would somehow signal to everybody, to the swarm of people, that Dogecoin, that the price of Dogecoin was going up, and so you should buy now and ride the wave.
Yeah, I mean, that's disturbing for sure, yeah. I mean, that guy is deeply disturbing. It's just everything he does, it's just like the way he wants to be able to control people's brains, potentially, the way he wants to set up a colony in Mars, the way he wants to change the night sky with his satellites, which I guess he's already effectively apparently changed the quality of light. I haven't really noticed this myself, but this has been going on. I mean, these ambitions are just so big and so, like, not useful to most people. I don't know what can be done with him, frankly. Yeah, I mean, we can't do anything because we should go into politics and we could do something about him.
Yeah, tax him out of existence. It's we live in such a like surreal time where the wealthiest person on earth, he bumps around from like 1 to 10 every once in a while due to the price of Tesla, but how much of a memer he is when he's also like in his 50s, I think. You know, it's such a strange thing. You like cannot, if you had written a book about a billionaire memer in the 90s, I'm sure you like wouldn't have been taken seriously.
Well, that is weird. Yeah, there's certainly kind of a lot of weird stuff happening that doesn't seem really real. Yeah.
So I wanted to now transition a bit to talking about a couple of the specific memes. So of course, through a podcast, you won't be able to see it, but I can maybe share it on my website, which memes we're talking about, and I'll describe them. But so yeah, Elon Musk, he's this like super, yeah, billionaire memer. But I don't know if you saw this tweet from the @WSB chairman Twitter, but this tweet from him, from that account, says, "Life is one big meme, and the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, is the meme page admin." Like, this is, like, so, like, how much of a frenzy that caused was so crazy. And, like, then the news, like, I think a week later, of Tesla purchasing $1.5 billion in Bitcoin, which is, I don't know if you saw that. That was very,
Musk, is it his wife or partner? I guess they're married.
Yeah, Grimes, this is, I don't know if they're married or not, but they have a kid.
Yeah, she just made $5 million selling NFT, non-fungible token artworks. It was announced today. I think it's like therefore today or yesterday. So yeah, I mean, crazy, yeah. Because I mean, that is something that is, I don't know if it's the biggest single sale of an NFT artwork or artworks at once by one artist, but you know, she's going to change the artistic landscape in doing that. So I mean, they have just enormous power between them. Yeah,
and it's not like she's not the first musician to like involve blockchain in music. There's like plenty of music based applications using blockchain. But I think what's interesting is like her association with Elon Musk. Elon Musk being the meme page admin, and like how that probably, I would assume, like put probably a huge premium on the stuff that she's selling via the blockchain.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and just her proximity to him generally would do. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's weird because it's also kind of taken for granted. They're not. I don't really ever think of him as being that powerful, as a guy that craves a lot of power and kind of exhibits this in a clownish way. But I guess this is dangerous. I suppose that it does kind of is a bit Trump-like in that way, although very different, I suppose, in actual way he expresses himself. But that you just think he's pissing around all the time with his flamethrowers and things and ridiculous cars. And obviously he's doing something. He's doing stuff behind the scenes, you know.
If you talk to like a tech bro Elon Musk fan, like they may, I think they'll have the idea of the opposite, actually, that Elon Musk is actually very, he's very laid back. He's very chill. He doesn't care about power. He's just like hanging out. You know, he just likes funny memes. He's just like me, except with like billions of more dollars than me. But so like, I feel like the use of the memes for him in his context sort of like hides the actual callousness and like the actual power that he has. Like you use this like this humor of like the Dogecoin or like whatever other stupid memes he does as a way to like hide or mask the actual power that he has as a billionaire and as the owner of like very large companies.
Yeah, for sure. And I have no idea what he really owns, to be honest, apart from Tesla.
So SpaceX, the space one, and I think those are the two big ones. He had one of them, some green energy, solar power energy that I think joined with Tesla. But yeah, he has some pretty big companies. Also notably, I think it's interesting that these companies are ones that are not, like, at least in the case of Tesla, like it's definitely not valued at any sort of reasonable amount in terms of like traditional ways of measuring the price of a stock, like in terms of price to earnings or whatever else. It's horribly overvalued when compared to like traditional car companies like Ford or GMC. It's so much higher than those companies, and these other companies have real profits. It's this really weird detachment of reality even within like capitalism's own logic.
Yeah, well, for sure. Because there's always a distortion, but it's even more distorted.
But maybe moving on to the next meme. So I think it's pretty easy to spend a lot of time criticizing and shaming the people who may have partaken in all of this madness, and you can go in all sorts of directions. But, you know, I think one of the ways, at least as Marxists, I think we can take a look at it is through class. So there's this really interesting meme that I found. But it's this meme of Bernie Sanders with his mittens and his legs crossed, like the really famous one for the inauguration of Joe Biden. And in the background, it has this it has a candle chart, mostly going up, looking like it's about to skyrocket. And it says, "All I want is to become financially independent within 3 months by hodling a small amount of crypto and checking its value every 4 minutes."
So I think that is the kind of that's what you know, novice investors basically do, and I think it's interesting. I don't know what portion of the market is kind of very small and novice investors at any one time, but I don't think they tend to probably do very well. Anyone who's investing a very small amount of money is probably going to have to take it out at some point soon, because you know if you can afford it, you're probably investing bigger amounts. So I think people new to it tend to kind of dabble, put a little bit of money in, realize they don't have enough money to, I don't know, go out on a Friday night as we used to do before lockdown, and then they sell for whatever reason they sell. So I don't know. That's your experience of people.
I mean, I don't know for sure. I mean, the vast majority of people I know, I think just by nature of not knowing that many extremely wealthy people, is that of knowing people who have smaller amounts, maybe in cryptocurrency with the hope of like, you know, one day striking it rich because they held the correct one. But I think for this meme specifically,
I think the risk there is, sorry, because I had to say this, I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's not even very important, but the risk is that one forgets their passwords all the time. If you put a small amount of money in several cryptos, you end up forgetting which cryptos you have and even what platforms you have them on. That's why I found that myself. I've refound some of my currency in the last couple of months and invested in some more. But I think it's probably quite common. There's probably a lot of unclaimed crypto.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's absolutely true. But I just think it's crazy how this sort of like anxiety, I think, similar to some of the things that I've heard Mark Fisher talk about before in terms of like, you know, the anxiety you get of always being like connected to the digital world. But like this also anxiety of like constantly checking the price, especially in a world where in which like social democratic gains are sort of being lost over time. So that's why I think the Bernie Sanders aspect is also really interesting, of like having this this political figure who wants to provide healthcare in the U.S., who wants to provide a higher minimum wage, like all these other things that he had advocated for before, and how like all people want is like to be financially independent. And in a world where that is so difficult to do without social welfare, like one of the only maybe small bits of hope you have is to spend, you know, your extra cash into Dogecoin and hope that Elon Musk tweets about it. And then you can...
It's the Bernie seated, you know, at the inauguration with his mittens on, and he looks kind of hopeful and resigned. That's kind of how the meme looks, how he looked at that point. And I suppose there is that thing of like, that is what it's like for a lot of investors. Like, there's not much hope, especially, you know, in the last year. So, you know, you put a little bit into crypto and you hope, but you're also resigned because you're like, this isn't going to do anything probably for me. Or, you know, it's highly likely that I'm not going to get rich off this. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting like that. I mean, it is almost like, you know, the Constellation Prize. We can't have socialism, but we have got crypto to play around with. You know, unless we have like a crypto socialism, which I guess is your thing.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, if we don't have socialism, at least we can like trade our crypto tokens for fun. Well,
but it's funny how it's like, it is like a commodity fetish in the Marxist sense, you know, like commodities that has a value that goes in excess of its material value. You can turn money into something kind of more fun by investing it in crypto. You can see it go up and down. You can probably get it out, you know, at the same value you put it in at, if you're kind of careful. So you probably won't lose, or it's a good chance you won't lose anything. But you put it into crypto, and it takes on this other kind of quality, which is kind of cool, kind of meme-like. You see what I mean? It's a bit like having a new skin for your character in League of Legends or whatever thing people play. You know, why would you pay for a new skin for your character? But then it does something, obviously, for people. I don't really play. I used to play a bit of League. I never got a new skin. I couldn't see why, but I know that a lot of people did want this stuff. So much stuff we get today is like digitally owned. It's not really real. A lot of Kindle books we buy digitally. I think probably we're less likely to read than actual books, or it's similar. I think people buy books often and don't read them, and they've always been a fetish object. It's interesting that it's like memes, it's like YouTube, it's like a Patreon, you know, that you get all these Patreons that you don't look at that much, but it's kind of, you buy into something about the person who's made it, or more likely their platform. Yeah, so it's like, I support them, it's kind of cool, I feel kind of good about that. You kind of feel that you have something, but it's non-tangible. It's not really there, and I get that a bit personally. I get that off crypto.
Unless they become a patron of mine, then they do get something out of it.
Yeah, no, they get something on mine as well. On the asset left, we give a whole lot of stuff. But the thing is, I don't know. I better not say this, but shall we say, to put it in a better way, I don't know how much I'm looking at the people who I'm giving money to on Patreon. I think I'm getting much more off like the kind of the notion of ownership or of patronage of these. I feel a little bit like an art collector must feel, because you think, what are these art collectors getting that have so much money that keep buying, like they kind of spread bit and they buy many, many different artists at $1,000 each. This is kind of a principle of investment. If you're not buying like the blue chip pieces at a million, you buy many different young artists banking that one of them will end up being really big. So your money, you know, you will end up making loads of money. You don't put $1 million in one young artist. That would be dangerous. You put $1,000 in 100 young artists, for example. And you think, you know, how much is a collector getting off this? But I think they get something out of the experience. It's kind of a feeling. Patronage has its own kind of fetish value, shall we say, in the Marxist sense of fetishism. And I think this is the same with Patreon to an extent, but of course that's the whole point of it being Patreon. It's like being a patron. And I think you get it off the same thing as saying of crypto. So I think this is just a thought that's coming in my head. Sorry if this is kind of flow of consciousness stuff, but I think there's something to be said for this. There's a new economy happening of commodity fetishes that don't really exist. You know, it's certainly, even if they're giving something, it's much more about the fact of an ownership of a digital, part of a digital whole.
I've written a bit about commodity fetishism in the cryptocurrency space. I'd be curious to share it with you and get your thoughts with my very crude Marxist analysis.
Well, that'd be great. I'd be really interested because it's something I would like to look into more. I keep thinking I need to like revisit Marx then. I mean, his commodity fetish is fairly straightforward, but I'm thinking about if there's any other elements that might be useful. But I think this definitely warrants attention because, you know, Marx says that all value is predicated on labor. And I think that's essential to the socialist message. How much that's true or not, I don't know. But I think that it becomes somehow very true once you have an economic depression and you're like, okay, all our value is literally disappearing. In our banks, our investments are going down. You know, people are all having investments, and then you're down to how does one still hold on to some kind of value? And in that desperate position, you realise that the only value you really have is in labour, particularly being that, you know, in certain industries, everybody's probably buying their kind of base materials at roughly the same price. So the only way you're going to create extra profits by driving down the cost of your labor somehow. So, you know, when you get to things that aren't actually made or only made once, but then distributed like a lot, you know, video games, etc., avatars and games or new skins, etc., then this brings you to, well, actually, is there really labor value beyond this or, behind this? Is there a correspondent labor value that really means anything? Because eventually the labor value is far superseded by the value generated by just selling the game, if it's a video game, for example. So, I mean, I'm sure you've thought of all of this if you're looking into this kind of thing. But I think it's a very important area to try and fathom out what this really means.
So for one of my last questions, I wanted to go to this one last meme because I think it's a very close link to Mark Fisher's work, and I think the work that probably you've written about in your newest book. But I think, ironically, a lot of the things, a lot of the issues that I think that we're coming across in terms of memes and crypto can be summarized by this pretty infamous, at least on the left, meme, this "we should improve society somewhat" meme. So you have the feudal peasant who's saying "we should improve society somewhat," and then the little guy popping out of the well, he's saying, "yet you participate in society, curious, I'm very intelligent." So although it comes from like a very stupid place most of the time from the right, I think that there is a little bit of truth to it. And I have a hunch that because we aren't answering that question very clearly on the left, is why partially maybe we're getting what Mark Fisher describes in Capitalist Realism. So you mentioned that in your new book, you talk a little bit about how we can sort of counter capitalist realism. But how do you think, maybe if you have any tips on like the best way to navigate this space, especially for what I would call the crypto left, or people who just want to imagine something different when it comes to what is perceived as being super capitalistic, like blockchain.
But you mean literally like how should we improve society? I think like the meme is good because it's just so true that you get this like, oh, you're making left-wing videos, but you're using YouTube. You get this quite a lot in different forms. And I think one thing is that we have to just be very clear with ourselves about our level of responsibility, or how would you say, level to which we're involved with capitalism, that is no good thinking we're not, and it's no good pointing the finger at people saying, oh, you know, you're somehow to some degree involved in capitalism, therefore you can't challenge it. I think the answer is going to have to come somehow from within. And actually, that's what Marx said, and that's what Adorno and the whole Frankfurt School said in their various different ways. So actually, for Adorno, the artwork can resist capital to some degree because the artwork is basically an illusion, and so is capital. So the commodity fetish is an object that kind of claims to have things in excess of its core kind of material self, so people buy into it, and then the objects end up kind of ruling over the people. And Marx said that the artwork, it kind of does this to a much greater degree because it pretends to be completely autonomous altogether from society. So you have an artwork that claims to be a landscape or an abstraction, you know, which is kind of otherworldly. He would call this, Adorno called this, the absolute commodity. And he said because it kind of claims to be separate from society, it can kind of lead people into a suspended kind of dreamlike state in which they realize their true link with nature, that we're not separate from nature and each other. And this is exemplary of how we can live in better ways, this kind of linking this with nature. So, I mean, that's interesting. I think a similar thing is applicable to memes and generally, that we have to see them as kind of cunning ways of evading the system from within. So, you know, there's this whole thing of memes actually being held online, therefore they're part of the data economy. This is clearly the case, but, you know, at the same time, you know, we're kind of fulfilling our role within the data economy, probably not upsetting capitalists too much then. At the same time, we can hopefully spread counter-capitalist or socialist messages. So, you know, I think that could be applied to crypto if I only knew how. But I'm sure there are ways of working within crypto and trying to yield something better. But there's a lot of work to be done. We just have to keep kind of playing around with these things.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. So maybe to cap it off, love to know, where can people keep up with you and your work and your new book?
Okay, well, I have this platform, said The Acid Left. On Instagram, it is at The Acid Left. YouTube, you can find us doing a simple search. And my website is mikewatson.fi for Finland, because I'm actually in Finland. And that's probably enough. You can keep in touch, find me in those ways. And yeah, great. Thanks for having me. It's been a brilliant conversation.
Yeah, it's been really great. Yeah, hopefully we can improve our memeing and create socialism through that.
Yeah, and improve our blockchain investment.
and get rich in the process. All right, thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thank you.